This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. What if, during a fight with your spouse, you said, "Do me a favor, die," and the very next day, he or she did just that? That's what happens in the opening pages of Carol Muskie Duke's new novel, Life After Death. Boyd Schaefer is furious with her husband, Russell, because their four-year-old daughter, Freddie, while in his care, winds up alone in a city park. Russell says they were playing hide-and-seek. He was hiding. He tells his wife he had climbed into a playground statue, one of the seven dwarves, and he got stuck. He couldn't get out until finally some passers-by heard Sneezy yelling for help. Boyd isn't buying the story. She's had enough of Russell's stories. He also tells her he's dying, that he has an incurable disease. She says, "You have an incurable disease? Don't get cured. I'd prefer you dead. Do me a favor, Russell. Die." The next day, he dies of a heart attack on the tennis court. Poet and novelist, author of Life After Death, Carol Muskie Dukes, is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, you can join the conversation with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The author of two previous novels, six volumes of poetry, and a book of essays on women and poetry, Carol Muskie Dukes is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Southern California. She also heads the PhD program in creative writing and literature at USC. She's the recipient of many awards and grants, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and several Pushcart Prizes. Muskie Dukes' latest novel, Life After Death, is published by Random House. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Carol Muskie Dukes, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
The characters in this book are wonderful. Tell us about Russell and why it is that Boyd doesn't buy the Sneezy story.
Well, Russell is meant to be one of those amazing, charming, feckless types who... you know, is really basically, I think, good-hearted, but he just can't quite grow up. And she describes him as a liar, and he's a very cheerful liar, that is to say. He invents realities in a way and invents the world the way he wants it to be. So she, being a different type, loses patience with him periodically.
Yeah. In the opening of the book, you write, "Russell was a liar, so relaxed and so appealing a liar that his lying seemed less like deception than a kind of good cheer." How do you feel about Russell and Boyd? How do you feel about those two characters?
Well, I feel, I feel I have a number of feelings attached to this, the whole situation of Russell, for, you know, other reasons, too, that take place outside of the novel in a way, but I think that... the way I feel about Russell and Boyd, in a way, points to a larger issue of marriage itself. The passage you indicated in describing the novel, her saying to him, "Why didn't you just die?" Is shocking on the face of it. But I think that married couples and other partners in relationships say things like that to each other in stress and in extreme emotion. I don't want to say often, but I think it happens. It happens in relationships, and yeah. I think that their relationship is not so uncommon. I don't think that Russell and Boyd, in other words, represent an atypical couple necessarily. I think what I'm trying to say is that I think every marriage is mysterious. Every marriage has its secrets and its tragedies and its great joys. But it, you know, I think that often our private lives and our relationships are inscrutable to others. Are indecipherable.
After you finished this novel, your husband, the actor David Dukes, died, like Russell Schaefer, of a heart attack.
Yes.
And you dedicate the book to your husband. As you've mourned his death, have you found yourself thinking about the characters you had created for this book, or rethinking them?
Well, I've been asked that question a lot, actually. To answer in a word, there's two ways to look at that. One is that, you know, this was an incredible coincidence in that, you know, art imitates life or something like that. I happen not to believe that view. I think that what I do think is that fiction writers and poets and writers in general work in this area of the unknown. I mean, the unconscious. It's what we do when we write. I mean, the imagination transforms everyday life. We may take things here and there from everyday life, but then they become something else in this process of becoming fiction. We work in that terrain of coincidence and dream and chance and so on. So I think it was a coincidence, but I think that, you know, it was both a coincidence and in a way also a kind of occurrence that would happen, that could happen in the realm of the imagination in terms of what seems like a prediction. That said, I, having gone through a death like this, so shocking a death, my husband appeared to be in great physical shape. He was an actor. He was extremely active. Obviously, he was playing tennis when he died. He also played handball and was in general, it seemed anyway, looked to be in great shape. But he wasn't. He had coronary artery disease. Having gone through this terrible loss, I think I would perhaps not necessarily rethink the characters, but I think I would rethink perhaps the context of the way the death is presented to Boyd, for example, the female protagonist. In other words, I discovered when my husband died that there are so many people and authorities who come between oneself and one's own mourning. In other words, you think death is a private matter. It isn't. Suddenly, the state is involved. In my case, the state was very involved. Because my husband died, he had been home for the weekend. He was shooting a miniseries called Rose Red up in Seattle-Tacoma area. We live in Los Angeles. And he had been home for the weekend visiting my daughter and me. He had gone to a function at my daughter's school, blah, blah, blah. He flew back on a Monday, October 9th. The first year anniversary is coming up. And he got up to Seattle-Tacoma and decided to go out and play tennis. What I'm trying to say is he died on the court. What I'm trying to say is that he died out of state. And therefore, he was subject to the medical examiner's office in that county where he died. And I unwittingly gave the wrong answer to a question that the medical examiner's office asked me. They called me right after I just heard he had died. I'd heard from the emergency room doctor that he was dead, and then I got this call from this coroner or medical examiner's office, and they asked me if he had a local physician. I said no, and that was the key answer. I want to give advice to all the listeners you have that if you're ever in this situation, do not say no, he doesn't or she doesn't have a local physician, because at that point, if you say no, these people take your loved one away, and you have no more say over what happens. In other words, they took my husband's body, and I wasn't thinking, because, in fact, the miniseries could have sent over a doctor who was attached to the miniseries, but I said the wrong thing. They took his body. At that point, they took full control. They refused to let my daughter and me fly up to Seattle to Tacoma to see him. They refused to allow us to have any access to him. They did an autopsy without my approval. They did a number of other indescribably horrible things, and including a very, very poorly done autopsy report. This is the Pierce County Medical Examiner's Office near Tacoma, Washington. And they were inhuman. They were like the DMV of death. So I had to deal with the state. I had to deal with the funeral industry, which is a whole, which I certainly get into in the book, but there's a whole, I certainly learned more in the course of this tragedy. And, you know, religion pops up, family members have their view. You know, what you find is that people and authorities, essentially authority moves in between you and your own experience of death, between you and the person you've lost. So I think that what I would do is probably I would enhance, I would certainly intensify that context. And I think I would also make Boyd a little less, she's in shock, obviously, mm-hmm. in the first chapters, but I think I'd make her a little less flip, you know, because death is so completely disorienting. I suppose her reaction could be a reaction, but I think that, you know, I think I would intensify more her own feelings of obvious grief breakdown. So, yeah, I mean, mainly the authority issue, though. I think I would definitely, you know, I've learned so much more about that now, unfortunately. I would intensify.
Yeah. You know, that's something that, you know, I had really not given any thought to, the fact that after a death, it is so public, and there's, you know, generally a service, and there's so much to do, and there's business to take care of. And
well,
then,
that's just one aspect, and that's more private, even though it's public. The funeral is another. Yeah, it's another aspect.
Yeah.
But then there is the state. Everybody has to deal with some sort of death certificate. I mean, it's just, and it's unbelievable. I mean, I don't think anybody knows about this coroner's office thing, that they have all these little fiefdoms that have complete power. They're little, you know, little tyrants in these little offices who, if you die out of state or someone you love dies out of state, can take full control, can take the control away from you, the family.
We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello. Yes?
Yes. Yeah, I can just barely hear you. Is that okay?
That's
okay. Can you
hear me? We can hear you.
All right. Strangely enough, I'm a funeral director, and I'm very empathetic about what your guest is saying and all the red tape that is involved with a death out of state. And I would like to hear about her experience with the funeral industry, because often they are used as the whipping boy for a lot of things that needn't occur or shouldn't occur if an independent funeral home is selected. So I'd be very curious. I'll hang up and listen to her comments. And again, my condolences on the loss of your husband. It should have been handled much better by both the coroner's office and apparently by the funeral director.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Do you want me to just go ahead and respond?
Yeah.
First of all, I was going to say that if he wants to read the book, it's called Life After Death, and actually I did a tremendous amount of research prior to the book's publication, obviously, to my writing the book, on the funeral industry. I am originally from Minnesota, and through family contacts back in Minnesota, though I live in Los Angeles, I was able to do research on funeral homes and funeral directors and how bodies are treated after death and embalming and so on. And I was very moved by what I saw in Minnesota, actually. And it moved me so much that I changed the book from what was originally a satire. I intended to write a satire on the death industry, like The Loved One by Evelyn Waugh, which many of your listeners know, I'm sure, which was a satire of Forest Lawn, oddly, where my husband ended up. But I decided after I went to Minnesota and really looked into the funeral industry that most of the time there is a real rapport between funeral directors and the grieving family and survivors and so on, and it's a very legitimate one. And most of the time I believe that bodies are really handled with great reverence and so on. I think that, and this gentleman who called, I think, will be very familiar with this. I think there's a huge, big corporate industry that has been buying up a lot of the small funeral homes. This has happened over the course of the last 10 years or so. I think it's called SCE or something like that. Anyway, it apparently has taken away some of the more specialized neighborhood kinds of services and centralized the embalming and so on. But that's a whole other issue. That's part of what I, you know, that's sort of the background for some of what happens in my novel, too, is there's a character who's a funeral director, and he's very sympathetic. His name is Will Youngren, and he's the young heir to about three or four funeral homes that he runs, that he inherited from his father. He's very sympathetic. What happened in my case with David, my husband, was that first of all, his body was very badly embalmed up in Tacoma, because there's apparently an interstate law or whatever, federal law, that a body can't be flown anywhere unless it's embalmed. So before he could come down to Los Angeles after this horrendous, you know, kidnapping of his body by the coroner's office in autopsy, he was sent to a funeral home close to this medical examiner's office. Of course, I didn't know any funeral home up there, so they just sent it to somebody they knew, and those people did an incredibly awful job, so that he looked so bad when he arrived in Los Angeles that Forrest Lawn, who received the body, told me that it probably did not want to see him. Well, I did see him, and it was awful. Forrest Lawn did their best to, you know, to improve the way he appeared, and we did have an open casket, but there were a lot of problems that happened, a lot of things that happened with Forrest Lawn that were mainly just organizational problems. They weren't the kinds of things that happened with the coroner's office up in Tacoma. But I do think that, and again, this man who called in will know about this, that as the funeral industry becomes more corporatized, more sort of mega corporatized, it loses its one really powerful selling point, I believe, which is that one-on-one relationship with families and with the grieving parties, because that is everything. I mean, you know, when you have lost someone, you don't want to talk to a CEO or a functionary of a company. You want to talk to somebody who really seems to care. And I think that still is often the case, but I think it might be changing.
Yeah. Well, the undertaker in your novel, Will Youngren, as you mentioned, he cares very much.
Yeah, he does. Will cares a lot, and so does Griggs,
right.
Who's the embalmer, who I started out, I based him originally on Joy Boy, who was the character in The Loved One, the novel I mentioned before by Eva Lenoir. And he kind of was a hangover from when the novel was a satire, but I liked him so much I kept him. He really is, he was fun to write, and he is really, but he really deeply cares, as you said about Will as well.
At this point, maybe this would be a good point to read an excerpt from the novel where we really get to meet Jartan Eugene Griggs, who's an embalmer.
Yes.
At the funeral home. Would you read an excerpt from that chapter where we meet him?
Sure.
As he's meeting up with Will at a tavern?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the last
one. Oh, in this scene, he's meeting up with his boss, the funeral director, Will Youngren, at a tavern.
Yes. I don't know if you want me to read the whole thing, but maybe I'll just read a description of Griggs and a little bit more.
Great.
A couple of paragraphs, because it's a whole chapter. But the description of Griggs, his name is Jartan Eugene Griggs, resplendent in a starched Madras plaid shirt and Kelly green tie, bought Will a drink. The bright oxblood hue of his still thick hair asserted itself even in the dim light of Tolson's lounge. But it was his voice that gave him immediate authority. As his lips moved, the mellifluous broadcast tones of an FM radio announcer, resonant and avuncular, swelled cello-like from his chest. Griggs enjoyed legendary stature at Youngren's mortuary. He was an embalmer extraordinaire. A quote from him, "Give me Liza Minnelli stiff. I tell you, breathing takes something big from that gal." And he'd been around ever since Will could remember. He was the first person Will's father had hired over 30 years ago. His much-admired interpretations of the deceased, ostensibly for the benefit of the bereaved, included research into the deceased's eccentricity of dress and toilette, close examination of the deceased's favorite photos of himself, and long periods of listening hard, as he put it, to the desires of our silent clientele. Griggs loved the dead and did not fear them. He was deeply committed to their beautification. It was the living with whom he had trouble. He unnerved healthy companions by abruptly fixing them with a speculative professional gaze, measuring the air about their ears and brows with his long spatulate fingers, crooning a little Cole Porter under his breath, like the beat, beat, beat of a tom-tom. and jotting comments with exclamation points in a tiny notepad he kept in his breast pocket. He had a certain expression that had become notorious, nicknamed the death ray. Gossip had it that if he fixed you too long with this book, you'd end up for certain on his embalming table. Tonight, Griggs signaled Roy, the bartender, for refills, and Roy yelled back, "Hey, Youngren, he's looking at me in that way again." When Will looked over, Roy, who was fat and bald, made a guillotine gesture under his chin and pretended to shudder. Will shrugged good-naturedly, and Griggs turned around and smiled very slowly and sweetly at Roy, who made a cross of swizzle sticks and held it up in their direction. I think that's probably gives you a sense of what Griggs was like.
Yeah, yeah. Two terrific characters.
Thank you.
What was the inspiration for this novel? You said it started out you wanted to do a satire.
Yeah, I've always loved this book, The Loved One, which was written by Evelyn Waugh, whose work people I'm sure remember and know. He's a wonderful British writer, who wrote a satire of Forest Lawn, the Memorial Park out here, and it was a complete satire of the whole idea of the cosmetization of death, you know, the sort of commodifying and cosmeticizing of the whole process of death. And I always thought it would be fun to do a kind of a novel inspired by The Loved One. And so when I originally started doing my research in Minnesota, I had that in mind. But then, as I said, I became so moved by the people that I met, the funeral directors, the people, the embalmers, the people who worked in funeral homes, that I, and by the dead themselves, you know, the people who had died, who are kept away from us. It's so sad that in our society what we do is we sequester death, we sanitize it, we move it away from discourse, from our everyday lives. We just disappear death. The way my husband was treated in Tacoma by that Pierce County Medical Examiner's office is in a way just an extreme example of what already happens. The way bodies are taken away, people are vanished, and then the next time we see them, they're sort of made into an abstraction. You know, a kind of made up, you know, sort of. Highly colored version, you know, only pale version at the same time, a version of the person who once lived. We see them in abstraction in a way when we see them, by the time we see them at a wake or viewing or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I'm not saying, I mean, people used to die at home. People used to be embalmed at home. I'm not saying they should be embalmed. People should embalm their own dead. But I think that there's a way that we need to be more able to talk about death and what happens to people after they die, what happens to the bodies after they die. I was, frankly, ended up just being interested in the process of embalming, what happens to us, you know, when we become bodies only and after death. And that whole process, which is kept completely secret. And so, you know, I, in the process of being moved and changed by this whole experience, I began to write a different novel, and my characters emerged, and they begin telling me what to do, which is usually what happens, I find, when I write a novel. I'm a poet first, not really a novelist. I'm a novelist second, and so I have to kind of find my way through the dark, and my characters tend to lead me through the plot. They are the plot, in a sense.
Yeah.
As Virginia Woolf said, I think character is plot, so, and character is destiny, so that's really, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah. Russell Schaefer wants to be an artist. He wants to be a poet, but he's a rather bad poet.
Yes.
But those bad poems could make his wife laugh.
His wife laugh?
Laugh, yeah. Uh-huh. I'm thinking of a scene in the book where she's talking with her mother-in-law. Boyd is talking with her mother-in-law after the death of her husband and recalling, I believe it's the... It's something that leads up to their engagement, mm-hmm. Russell and Boyd's engagement. Would you read that? There's just a couple of paragraphs there on page 23 that I think would give us a sense of Russell and Boyd together.
Sure. Boyd talking to Gerda, who is her mother-in-law. This is after Russell has died, and they are, as you said, remembering his courtship of her. Boyd is a doctor, a medical doctor, and she was in medical school at the time in New York. He flies to see her in New York from Minnesota. And she says, he wrote some poems for me. I opened the front door, and there were butterflies floating in the foyer. I thought they were butterflies, but they turned out to be origami, 100 of them. He had written 100 haiku on paper wings. It sounds so, you know, I usually hate that kind of thing, but it was so neat. He kept blowing on them to get them flying around. Then we sat down on the steps and read them. Big setup and god-awful poems. She shakes her head. Awful. I mean, like, storm clouds over Mount Fuji. Why does everyone keep picking on me? Or one about two frogs who fall in love with a foghorn. Big honker across the river. What's a frog's serious heart to you? I started laughing and I couldn't stop. He was so funny, Gerda said. He was more than funny. He was, you know, dangerous. I might find an exploding cigar around here somewhere, a bomb. You know what I mean? I don't want to find stuff.
That's fabulous. That's Carol Muskie Dukes reading from her book Life After Death, her novel Life After Death. This also goes to, you know, one of those things that we all learn eventually in marriage, or maybe we're wiser than that and learn it beforehand. But, you know, it's like, how much do we know about one another? How much can we know about one another? How much do we want to know about one another?
Right. Well, I think that there is a... one of the things that happens in the novel is that Boyd finds her husband, Russell, who died, finds his journals and some poems that he has written and kind of daily jottings to himself, and she reads them, and her reading of the novel pages and the poems is kind of interspersed throughout the novel. And at one point, Russell says, something about that, saying, how is it that we never, no matter how long we live throughout our whole lives, ever really know another person? And I think that's true. I think that in or out of marriage, in whatever situation, it's almost impossible to know another person. We're so mysterious. We're such worlds unto ourselves, even though we think that we are close to people, and we are, and we love people. This is not to say we don't love deeply and that we don't love intensely, but that complete self-revelation, complete understanding of another as well, I think is impossible. And I think death really brings this home, obviously. You know, when someone dies, we realize how little we knew that person. We are shocked by it, in fact. People are always talking about, oh, I didn't say this, I didn't do that, if I had only let that person know, whatever. That's part of it. And then the other aspect of it is just that feeling of immense loss, which is exacerbated by that sense that we will never know so much of who that person was.
And this is intensified in this story between Boyd and Russell, because Russell is this, quote, relaxed and appealing liar.
Right.
A teller of tall tales.
Right. He is, for whatever reason, he's always a mystery, but maybe because he's a poet, maybe because he's kind of an odd one out. I mean, he was sort of an unwanted child and yet was born into wealth. He always was kind of a renegade or a rebel. He sort of makes sure that nobody knows exactly who he is. And spins various webs, you know. So you don't really get, you may think you know him, but then he turns again and changes. So he cultivates that mystery in a way, even more than people do typically, normally.
But you also might find yourself thinking a little bit of Diogenes, philosopher, in his search for an honest man.
Right.
There's no such thing. Is lying something that you've examined in previous work?
Well, I think that I guess I have in the sense that I'm a fiction writer. You know, I think that we are liars. You know, I think that, and I don't mean, obviously this is not, I'm not speaking of lying as a pathology here. I'm speaking of it as an invention. We are all liars. All of us are liars. Every person alive has not only just lied, we've all lied, but we fabricate all the time. We make up stories about ourselves. We tell ourselves the story of our lives. You know, I'm so-and-so, I do this, I'm defined by that, my parents are so-and-so, I was born here, this is my job, this is who I am. It's not that those are lies, but in a way they're fabrications. Those are narratives we make up to keep ourselves sane, to keep ourselves going on, you know. I mean, to believe that we are, in fact, that our lives make sense, when in many, many ways our lives don't make sense at all. The big fact being that we're born and then we die. I mean, the fact that we die is such an appalling, overwhelming, you know, totemic, monolithic truth that in a way we have to lie to ourselves to keep ourselves going from day to day. The fact of death alone makes liars of us. But also I think that if, you know, those of us who write, those of us who are artists, you know, I think anyone, in fact, who keeps a diary or journal or whatever, also lies in the sense, in the good sense of creating something. That's fiction writing. You're making up stories. You're making up things that never existed before in the world. In that way, you are godlike. You are, you know, the author of a new universe, whatever. So I've had experiences with it, and I believe that every time we write, in a sense, we lie. And Picasso said famously at one point, we lie in order to tell the truth in art. You know, we create things that aren't true. That's why when people first begin writing, they feel an allegiance to the facts because they believe the facts are the truth. I'm not a big fan of memoirs for this reason, because I don't think anybody can really remember exactly what happened. We always fictionalize. We have to. You remember selectively, you edit things, you embroider. But, you know, when people first begin writing, they often say, well, you know, and other people say this doesn't work as a piece of fiction or poetry or whatever, they'll say, but it really happened like this, as if that's a defense of art. It's not. In art, you make things up. It may have a kernel of truth of something or fact or whatever happened, but then it's transformed by this process, the same process that we use when we lie, which is, you know, invention.
Yeah. And thinking about memoir, if it's a good memoir, I enjoy the genre, but it is different from autobiography. In autobiography, I expect things to be more factual. And memoir, I expect to be meandering, perhaps a bit fanciful. It's someone, you're sitting down talking with someone or listening to their story.
It's the narrative. We all tell ourselves narratives. It's sort of naive to believe that the facts are the truth. In other words, that, you know, there is one way to tell a story. Rashomon, you know, all these examples of, you know, the same thing happening and then four or five different people telling their versions of the facts tell you that there is no one truth. From Plato onward, we know this anyway, I think, in our lives, that we can only tell, in a way, that narrative that we tell ourselves, that I mentioned before, that keeps us going. So when we write a memoir, we say, I believe, I happen to enjoy memoirs too, but I believe they're works of fiction primarily, regardless of what people say. You know, and I think that autobiography is, you know, yeah, it might have facts. There'll be facts about so-and-so was born here and born there, but is that a life? Does that capture a life? I don't think so. I mean, people are far too mysterious to be reduced to a set of facts. You know, you can give a set of facts about yourself, and then you know you're something other than just those statistics, vital statistics on a page.
Life After Death is set in your hometown, St. Paul, Minnesota. Why did you want to set the story in St. Paul?
Well, I also wanted to write about Minnesota. I not just because I grew up there, although that was part of the reason. I mean, I also wanted to write about my hometown, which I think is a very beautiful city. And, you know, again, speaking of the story we tell ourselves, you know, there's always a mystery attached to the place where we grew up, and we think of it always as special, charmed, or we hate it, or we love it, or whatever, right? So there was that, but also I because I did my research there, I was able, as I said, through a family connection to my sister married someone who was a part of a family of mortuary owners and had been for, you know, some years, a family business. I was able to do research there. So it seemed kind of natural to set it there as well, rather than, say, Los Angeles. It seemed like, you know, it made sense to set the story there for emotional reasons, I think, you know, having to do with it being my hometown and the fact that I'd done my research there.
Yeah. There's a scene in the novel where Russell proposes to Boyd and he tells her they should get married because both of them are Minnesotans.
Right.
And later there's a scene in the kitchen and WCCO is on the radio.
Right.
And there are commodity prices like there are here.
Uh-huh.
On the radio, and Scandinavians laughing at themselves.
Right.
Is the sense of place and its connection to identity stronger in Minnesota than it is, or in the Midwest, than it is in a place like L.A.?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, because, I mean, L.A. is really made up, well, not entirely. Let's put it this way. L.A. is often perceived as a place where people are arriving from other places. They're transient. You know, they're relocated here. They're coming here to make their way in the movies or in, you know, something related to the industry or as a surfer or they just like the weather or whatever, right? It's a town that seems to be constantly shifting in identity, L.A. There's much been written about this recently. In fact, I was just reading something in the L.A. Times Book Review yesterday about this, about how L.A. has not defined itself. And in a way, that is the nature of L.A., not to define itself, given its main industry and all the rest of it, that it is based, it's the capital of illusion in a way. Absolutely no, that the sense of place in the Midwest is, I think, far stronger. But it's also strong in a place like New York, for example. Although New York also participates to some degree in that capital of illusion thing, too, because for the same reason, there are lots of people coming in, you know, not that they're not coming into the Midwest, but they're coming in more, let's say, for what are ultimately reasons that have to do with perfecting, perfecting a dream, let's say, or following some sort of career ideal or something, and a kind of illusion, perhaps. So, you know, I think that sense of place is far stronger in Minnesota, let's say, or Ohio, or wherever.
L.A., memoir of memoir of memoir.
It's what?
Memoir of memoir of memoir.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The illusion.
When did you begin to write?
Oh, God. It seems like forever ago. I began to write when I was a very little kid because my mother was, who was from North Dakota and grew up during the Depression, wanted to be a poet and a writer and never could really follow that dream. And she married and had kids but had grown up in that generation, maybe the last generation, that memorized poems by rote, as they used to call it, and would stand up and declaim. You know, they would recite as part of their class preparation. And she loved poetry, and she knew pages and pages and pages of Tennyson and Milton and Wordsworth and Dickinson and, you know, on and on by heart. And so I grew up hearing my mother's voice reciting these poems, and I think that I just, you know, it was like amniotic fluid that I I floated in this amniotic fluid of language, and I just didn't really have a choice. I knew I was going to be a poet from the time I was really small. I might have, you know, been fulfilling a dream of hers, I guess, in some way. But I felt a sense of real, it's awful when you think about it, this you know, precocious, awful little kid, you know, writing and reciting poems and stuff. But that's what I was like. I wasn't really creepy, but I did have a sense of, you know, wanting to be a poet from a very young age.
In your work, there are little hints that here and there, in the work that I'm familiar with, and I can't really say I'm familiar with your work. But there is an epigraph at the beginning of Life After Death. Aha, she cried and shook her wooden leg, and that is your mother, Elsie Muskie.
Right.
Yeah. And then in Women in Poetry, there's a lovely story. The collection of essays on women and poetry contains a story about you as a little girl swinging on a swing.
Mm-hmm.
with your mother pushing you and reciting a poem by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Right, right. Well, that's nice you remember that. Yeah, when my mother, when I was about four or five, my mother used to, and maybe younger, my mother used to push me on a swing in the backyard, and as she would push me outward, she'd begin reciting, "How would you like to," famous poem everyone knows by Robert Louis Stevenson, "How would you like to go up in a swing, up in the air so blue? Oh, I do think it's the pleasantest thing that ever a child could do. Up in the air and over the wall till I can see so wide, rivers and trees and something and all over the countryside, till I look down on the garden green, down on the roof so brown, up in the air I go flying again, up in the air and down." Well, you can hear the swing there, right? You can hear, "Up in the air I go flying again, up in the air and down." And I remember hearing that over and over, you know, her words, and I felt like I was swinging inside the poem, you know, that her words would, Stevenson's words, rather, and my mother reciting them would lift me up and carry me over and then back down, back to her, and then she would push me out into the world in a sense, you know, but I wasn't old enough to for the swing to break and carry me out into the sky, but I would swing back to her arms and then out again and back again, and it described a shape, a beautiful shape, I thought, that shape of swinging, and it became the shape of the poem, the rhythm of the poem, the shape of the poem itself for me, so the poem became almost physical for me, almost visible in the air, and the sound of my mother's voice, of course, was part of that shape. So I, that's a really good example, thank you for bringing it up, of what I'm talking about, because that was the authority of my mother's voice, the beautiful sound and the ringing syllables of that poem, and then combined with my mother's voice really, made the world poetry for me.
It's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Today, as you write poetry, do you have that kind of visceral sense of poetry, the words and the poem? Do you have a bodily feel?
Well, I like to think that I do. I mean, I've written about this, obviously. That essay was one of my attempts to write about shape in poetry, and I have done so in other cases. I mean, there's a book out from Oxford right now that just came out, an anthology called The Eye of the Poet. A bunch of poets, there must be seven of us, Billy Collins and me and somebody else, a few other people, David Baker and so on, write about various aspects of poetry. And I write about, essentially, I guess my topic is what is a poem, and I write a lot about shape. But it's funny, when my husband died, I really felt as if the solar system shifted. I mean, I wasn't one of those really dependent women, but a marriage is a marriage, and we were so connected to each other. And when he died, I felt as if, you know, the sun was gone, or the whole galaxy had shifted. And I had been writing what I think probably were more and more abstract poems prior to his death. After he died, I couldn't read, I couldn't write, I couldn't eat, as many people are. I was just in this state of profound, almost suspended animation. And then a couple months, I think it was, after he died, I suddenly woke up in the middle of the night one night and got this flood of poems, this it's the only way I can describe it, just this rush of poems came out onto the page. I started writing. This hadn't ever really happened to me before. Other poets have described this process, but it's never happened to me before. The poems that came out were much more visceral, much more shaped, and much more physical in a way than the poems I had been writing prior to David's death. They were poems that were much more, I think, literally based, in the sense that they seemed to be inspired by his death. I mean, they were actually, you know, things, moments from reacting to his death, but then they were things that moved into a kind of meditation about acting and poetry and so on, but still stayed very viscerally, I think, very viscerally connected, very connected to the sound of the voice. And that was a departure for me from what I'd been writing before. I feel as if now I'm writing in a way that I hadn't really known about before, or it had not been possible for me. I'm still grieving, I'm still in mourning, I'm still in this state of profound sense of loss, so I'm finding that the poetry is coming directly from that sense now, as opposed to before when I think my writing was much more cerebral, much more in the head, you know. Now it seems to be much more connected to my suffering heart, not to be too sentimental, but it seems to be much more grounded in that way.
Will these poems become part of a new collection?
I believe they I almost amazingly have a complete new collection of them now. I just, so many have come to me in this period of time, and yeah, I think they will be. I have to see. Some of them seem to me almost like pure documents. They're not maybe poems. Maybe they're more, you know, testimonies to an emotion. But many, many of them are poems, I think, and they will be part of a collection. Yes.
Hmm. Thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon, Carol.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
And the best to you, and I hope one of these days we'll talk again and talk more about poetry.
Well, I'd love to do that. Just let me know.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Carol Muskie Dukes has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We spoke with her this afternoon about her latest novel, Life After Death. She's also the author of 6 collections of poetry, the latest in Octave Above Thunder. She considers herself a poet before a novelist, but her novel, Life After Death, is a really good read. I would recommend it. It's published by Random House.